Hi, and welcome to this episode of the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by Jason and Matt. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Living.
We are heading down to the end of the street, to the end of Oak Street, to discuss the Anne Hathaway and Ewan McGregor dinosaur movie. A 70s retro kind of, was it 80s retro?
Maybe 1982. 80s retro. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember 1982, and we were way more fashionable than this. Never wore shorts that short.
And
I was
knee-high
in black.
Socks with stripes? I mean, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of problems with this movie.
Here's the thing, right? I have really fond memories of the 80s.
Yeah.
Really thought we were cool, and we listened to good music, and it was great. And I feel like my memory's completely defunct, or the art department went mental with kind of the wrong kind of thing.
There's a few good tracks though in this movie. A few good old eighties tracks, I think.
Yeah.
If memory serves.
I guess.
Okay, so before we get into the visual effects, and obviously we've seen a few dinosaur movies in our day. This is not the first dinosaur movie. Time traveling dinosaurs is an interesting thing. What do we actually think of the plot and the kind of movie as a whole? I'll start with you, Matt. What did you think?
Before I saw the movie, I read a review online and it said,
"Yep,
this movie is bonkers." And I thought that was a pretty good review because it is totally it's so ridiculous. Like, it is so dumb, but there is a degree to which I think if you go to a movie and that's sort of the underpinning premise of a film like this, right? It's just completely absurd and totally laughable on its face. But if you go to a movie like this and you go see it as I kept thinking this would be really fun with a bunch of friends as a teenager at a drive-in movie theater. Like, that's kind of what this movie feels like it's made for. Like, it doesn't feel like a serious piece of cinema. Like, if you thought the coolest parts of Jurassic Park were where the T-Rex eats the attorney, this is taking that notion and saying all right, the coolest parts of this are going to be dinosaurs eating suburbanites. And on that level,
I got to say, the point that, and spoilers alert, of course, for everybody that's not seen it, but the one that totally echoed what you were just saying is when the main lead actor, Ewan, gets his leg bitten off. And okay, this is definitely that. But sorry, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No, just in summary, I mean, it's not a great movie, but it's dumb and it's fun. And there are some fun effects in it. There's some weird look to some of it that I thought I noticed, at least in the screening I saw. I don't know if you guys did, in terms of just sort of color saturation and depth queuing and stuff that looked kind of a little bit odd. But other than that, I don't know, I had a good time. And it was great that it was only 96 or 97 minutes long.
Thank God.
Okay. So Jason, do you want to?
I was very excited to see this movie, as I am for most movies that I want to go to. I actually went to this, not because we're doing a show. I had read a bunch of stuff about it that wasn't plot related. And I was like, this is going to be super fun to that point. But I assumed fun meaning entertaining and good fun, not boring, annoying, what the hell's going on fun to the stuff we've alluded to. I think most importantly, 1982 feeling like 1952 was I just didn't understand anything that was happening in the movie from a stylistic standpoint. The plot beats were all over the place. That whole opening thing felt like a reshoot. The whole block party felt like a reshoot to give the audience a reason to latch onto in the opening scene that the characters are getting a divorce and thus setting up tension. I don't know. It was just ham-fisted all the way around. And to make Ewan McGregor wear a terrible wig and also to be the dumbest, weakest, non-partner
just to interrupt you there, I just thought that the block party thing, that was specifically some kind of, hey, back before we had iPhones, we used to all hang out on the corner and barbecue together, kind of, you know, back in the good old days when families were families and neighbors were neighbors.
That's,
and,
which is weird because like 1982 was rough, like with Reagan and the all the stuff coming in out of the 70s. I'm not trying to make it political, but it was not the 50s where people were getting together. It was like a rough time. And I just, they're trying to talk about like middle America wasn't affected by socio-political economics in 1982. It was a weird vibe. Anyway, the other problem I had was, and I guess it mirrors the conversation that, or the point I was just making about Ewan McGregor's character, is the daughter was super weird because they give her this, like, she wants to go to Cornell because she loves Carl Sagan. And unlike the, I forget which it is, I think it's Rory Culkin in Signs, where he's the expert, because he's, you know, not expert, but he's like the dorky little kid that's read all the books and he's educating everyone on aliens and everything. That makes sense. That's fun. I thought that's what they were going to do here with the daughter and the Carl Sagan stuff, but it actually meant nothing. They didn't make her smart really at all. And she had one comment about wormholes. And it was just wasted character setup for what could have been super fun.
Okay. So we actually have had emails from fans who are like hardcore into the science and physics and have actually applauded my Spider-Man-esque rants. So let me just give you my... Let me just give you my rant here about what totally ruined it for me. Not so much the high shorts, not so much the neighborhood romanticization of suburbia. The thing that just drove me nuts is they were in a town and the town got transported back in time. Now, imagine we just draw a dotted line around that and we're just going to call that an oval like of town that moved, okay, so inside the oval – they managed to get to a place, that is inside the oval that has this like wormhole thing. Now, it has to be inside the oval because if it's outside the oval, there wouldn't be a house there. There would be jungle of like,
exactly.
So now, so they jump through a hole there and land back in the swimming pool and they've gone back in time a bit.
You're saying at the end. You're saying at the end.
That's a MacGuffin thing. They've jumped back in time, which obviously allows them to save their father. But the trouble is they're now outside that circle because they don't like then go, oh, my God, this whole area is going to go back in time. Quick, we've got a car. Dad just turned up in the pizza thing. Let's get in car and drive out of town. They stay where they are in an area that by definition is going to go back in time because if it wasn't going to go back in time, they wouldn't have been able to – jump through the wormhole to get back, right? So by definition, when the black event happens, they shouldn't be able to look down on it from way up on high because that's like way outside the circle.
So I will argue that point in the dumb logic of this movie.
Yeah.
They showed like with the big dinosaur poop in the back of the guy's neighbor's yard briefly and some other small things, which they later pay off with these bubbles that are appearing prior to and clearly during the big, big bubble event. Yeah. I could live with an argument that the bubbles that were happening randomly, quote unquote, in once they had transported could be connected to a pre-big bubble move event because they were happening randomly and at that moment could have appeared outside of what later became the big bubble because there were these little bubbles popping around as well.
What has to have happened inside the logic of the film for the end to pay off is that the bubbles moved in space and time.
Well, but no, because never, don't know where the exit bubble is. They don't ever say it's the same bubble place for the little ones.
No, because they know when the big bubble happens, right?
Yes.
And they are in the big bubble, and in the big bubble, they find a little bubble in a house that's clearly located inside the big bubble.
No, I get it. My logic was that the little ones may be in different places. Whereas well, the big no, one but, is too but big. That's my to point. Be-
so you'd have to establish somehow that the small bubbles aren't just time bubbles, but they actually space move.
As well. Yeah,
time yeah, but space. They have to conveniently move about 3 kilometers or yeah. a couple of miles.
Well, sure, right? Of course.
Not to Australia from like America, but like, you know, just over the other side of where yes. we need to be. But there's no way that they would know that because
no, of course.
They appear back in the present time and go, oh, great, Dad's here, great. And then they just say, now we're just going to stay here and then watch our neighborhood go back in time. And it's like, well, why would you not think that you were going to just about to go back in time? I mean, it's great that they found the father again. I get that. Yeah. That's a neat trick. And then they do this whole, we're going to tell all our family members that we can to get out of town. So that at the end of the movie, the very, very end of the movie, they're hailed as heroes and she can write a best-selling book.
And now there's also two of the
yeah,
girls,
yeah.
which well, they then that. Also, which they also tie to like a really thin lesbian narrative in the film, which I have zero issue with, but pay it off, like make it a real point. It was super weird. For them but to like hint at it with a couple looks, pay it off at the yes. end with them holding hands. Exactly. But it was very weird.
It was very hinted at. But, and again, I have no problem with that. But my point is, I guess, you shouldn't need a whiteboard and markers and like things to explain to an audience what's going on.
You're telling me, Christopher Nolan, you know?
And like. So the other point is, the other point I would say is, so if that's the case, right, if you hold my logic that they go back in time or come forward in time and to a place that should obviously be about to suck back into time. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a McGovern thing that it's a bit before it's happened. Yeah. Then the audience, if you're not explaining it, you're just going, the audience is dumb and they won't notice this. Yeah. Like that sort of a major inconsistency.
Not my favorite way to interact with an audience, certainly as a filmmaker.
Yeah. I think you need to either be really like respectful to the audience and sort of say, yeah, we've thought this out. Like, I don't mind that they have a thing that they've turned up and it's before the events happened. That's like a convenient thing, but you know, okay. But had they just come back and then nobody mentioned that they've earlier than the event, the audience would be confused. So they mention that. But then the geo-positioning thing is almost like, yeah, that's going to really screw us if we try and explain that. Let's just skip that bit and assume that the audience just won't notice that the whole thing doesn't work logically.
Two things. A, you could look at a movie that spends the whole movie doing what we're saying should have happened, which is Donnie Darko, right? They spend the whole movie describing and talking about time, space, bubbles, and all this kind of stuff. But the other question in this, because we've all been patterned with Back to the Future and a couple other time yeah. travel movies to think about causal loops and all this kind of stuff. And like, there's ostensibly no causal loop in this because it doesn't happen again. Because they move forward in time and they have the two girls at the end. So ostensibly it was a one-time thing. They yeah. went back, managed to get the people out, and then it just disappears. My big problem is from a atmospheric standpoint, when they go to the dinosaur period, wouldn't yep. they all suffocate?
Why is that?
Or I mean, the air can't possibly be exactly the same in dinosaur time for humans, modern humans, as it is then. I mean, it's not like there is a dome. There's no dome. There's just, yeah, they're just there.
That's like less of a problem. I mean, like,
well, if we're talking science, you know.
Yeah, but you could ask you the question, like, is it reasonable that the audience never gets told why these bubbles happened, why they stop, why there was a few sure. and then there was a big one? Like, but you could also argue, well, you know, it's just a fun movie. But I just find it really offensive when you just kind of go, the audience won't notice that this doesn't make any sense.
I'm with you. And also, I was going into this assuming the MacGuffin was going to be, it was a Cloververse film, which, because it's J.J. Abrams, it's weird time stuff, and that's what they keep doing. And I, like, had that been the case, you explain everything, because the other Cloverfield movies have talked about these time ripples and these things that are causing these anomalous events. You wouldn't have to explain anything, because you would explain it by simply placing it into the Cloververse. So that's my own thing. I can't be disappointed that it was or wasn't, because it was not marketed that way and they didn't do it. So that's just my own thing.
Does the logic of the film bother you, Matt? We've been ranting about this.
No. I mean, I guess I like a movie about dinosaurs in the suburbs and a town in an electrical storm traveling back, you know, a billion years or whatever it is. Like, I mean, it's just so dumb. Like, but
it doesn't mean it can't be smart within reason. No one's asked looking for, like, you know, a 202 level physics class.
Yeah, and I guess I don't disagree.
But even in Avengers, right, where they have that great scene where he goes, you know, and he says, well, what about if you go back and that is our past and that's not our past and that's our future? And then he goes, are you just talking about Hot Tub Time Machine or Back to the Future?
Oh, right.
Yeah, every movie's told us that. And he goes, no, it doesn't work like that. And then they have one line about if I go back to my past and that's my future and if my future. And then it's like, and then the audience gets a laugh out of it. It's a fun scene. And you just acknowledge the fact that our rules for time travel are not the same as, you know, Hot Tub Time Machine.
I guess we move on. I would say, like, tonally, I think, like, eventually I felt like this movie kind of, like, it went from, like, absurdist comedy to, like, a kind of weird, like, horror dramedy. Like, and then I kind of felt like it came back around at the end to being sort of comical, but then sort of sentimental too. Like, I felt like it had an identity crisis. Like, it wasn't totally sure what it wanted to be.
I thought that Anne Hathaway had made so much money lately and done so many films that she was just doing a favor for a friend, and she hadn't
really bothered fully reading them.
I mean,
I
think his name is David Robert Mitchell, if I'm not mistaken, the director. He did a movie called It Follows, which is a fantastic film. And while, of course, I don't know this for sure, what this feels like to me watching it and knowing story structure and all the things that I care about for my own taste, not other people's, is that this was a very interesting script that got noted into the fucking ground by the studio and people who were like, no one's going to understand this. Make it dumb. Like, that's how it feels, because there's so many dropped threads of plot points that should pay off, that could pay off. The clear reshoot in the beginning, at least how it feels. These other things to set up these things that are just so unnecessary and weak storylines that are interesting that just never get built up. It feels like they got cut out either from the script or from the edit. And you just are left with this sort of middle of the road, like people will like the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
Seems fair. That's a fair assessment, I think, like overall of like the totality of the thing as a film. Like, I guess I didn't find myself thinking deeply about it during the movie or after the movie.
No,
like maybe only in this conversation, you know, but I did enjoy, like, I think the dinosaurs and the, like dinosaurs eating people and sort of if we want to get into talking maybe about some effects, like, I mean,
yeah,
I do think the big gross, like kind of almost like a Miyazaki looking but photoreal slug thing.
Yeah.
That thing that was in the pool and then it's coming up the stairs and
with the happy face.
Yeah, and it was like so adorable, but then it opens its mouth, you know, and it's like this horrifying thing. And I just kind of think, like, well, you know, it's like a dumb monster movie. It's like you don't watch you don't watch an old Godzilla movie, you know, and think like, well, this is pretty serious cinema. Maybe the original, but ones from the 70s, you know,
like they're made with different intents. Well, they're made with different intents at the time. Like those were Saturday, you know, Saturday afternoon monster
movies. You think this had a different intent as a movie?
Well, I'm not saying it did. It felt like it did, and then it got changed. That's what it felt like. It's not like I didn't. I enjoyed I enjoyed the movie in parts. But you know, like when he got his leg bit off, I was like, oh shit, that's super, wow, cool. They're killing the main character.
Before we go to the slug, before we go to the slug sequence,
yes,
and the visual effects of it, there's one other major plot thing that I find offensive, which is the reliance on kid doing stupid thing because of pet. Yeah.
Yes.
Like time and time again.
The dog. Yeah.
Yeah.
The dog. Like it's like in Superman in the flashback, he like runs out to save the dog. You know, like in Dawn of the Dead, like with Chips in Dante's Peak. Like there's just like every film you can think of. Independence Day. Somebody has to do something stupid to save Fluffy, and in doing something stupid to save Fluffy, threatens themselves and then everybody else around them that goes to rescue them because they went to save Fluffy, and then. Movie lore says the dog can't die, so against all odds, the dog survives because it's a cruel film if the dog actually gets killed and everybody hates that.
So now you saying that bit about the dog has triggered a memory. It's been a week or so since I've seen this movie, and with lots of other chaos going on and at my job and whatever. But it's interesting you bring up the dog because I do remember thinking, watching this movie in the first half, maybe where we start to get the sense of, you know, the parents are fighting, the kids are listening to the parents fighting. There's the implication of troubles ahead in the marriage, maybe divorce is on the horizon.
Well, they literally say it in the opening scene, they're getting divorced.
Oh, is that
what? Oh,
I don't remember. What I was going to say, though, is like with the dog and then with the dinosaurs and with the like alienated kids, like it felt like it was trying so hard to be like this E.T. Close Encounters kind of Spielbergian thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if you said that when I might have my
technical difficulties. No, I did not, but you are spot on.
But yeah, and it felt so, that felt really forced on the
That's
movie
the JJ in a stuff. Way
that just, it didn't, it was like, well, what does that have to do with any of this like...
Take you back to when you're a kid, right? If you're a kid and there are literally people being massacred all around you and eaten, and it's the middle of the night and there's no power and it's creepy sounds, are you thinking, I'm going after the dog? You're like, stupid dog, get back here. If you don't, fuck it. I know, you know, like at some point, it's just.
You know who doesn't go after the dog? I'll go back to the movie I talked about previously about smart kids. Signs. They don't go after the dog and the dog dies. Not that I advocate for that.
No,
that is a fact. That is a fact in that scenario. That's possible. It is a possibility. Now, can you bring the dog back at the end to have it save the day where it's been missing the whole time? Great. Love it. I love a good dog helping you out. I get it, but I'm just saying if you're going to do it, like having it be a plot driver for the kid is worse than the dog being missing the whole time and coming back and like biting the dinosaur at the last minute so it looks away. Like, but okay,
didn't you kind of feel like Ewan McGregor, though? Like, he's totally acting in the most tongue-in-cheek. Like, he just seems like he's like walking through it, like just kind of laughing the whole time. Like,
it's ridiculous.
Like he's not giving it his all. And to her credit or to her discredit, I don't know. Like Anne Hathaway, I think on occasion stumbles into like, you know, serious actor territory in a movie that tonally just does not call for it in a way. Like, you know, like. She's great. I like her in most stuff, but in this,
we're a long way off. Snakes on a Plane, so right? Weird.
Oh yeah, like, yeah.
You know, yes. Like I don't feel like the film was expecting you to be seeing it with a modicum of cynicism, sarcasm,
not at all. That's the problem.
Postmodernist kind of like interpretation.
It's not Anchorman.
So sadly, yeah, exactly. Okay, so now we get back to the slug. Yeah.
Yes.
So I have to say. If you were to just offer up two things, dinosaurs in full daylight, well obscured by glass, by trees, by a bunch of stuff, I'm like, tick, did it in you know, looks like it's in full light, tick, like really made it look like it's behind that smudgy bit of window pane and does it feel like it's in the leaves? Yeah, tick, tick, tick. And then you get to the slug, the snake thing, and I'm like, you're kidding me, right? It's a character design skin problem that mm-hmm. just there's just no, it just doesn't feel threatening. It feels like a, and I know what they were kind of after. They were kind of after that prehistoric kind of goofy looking sort of reptile, but it just didn't do it for me. I think the staging of it coming down into the house and she doesn't see it is humorous and kind of like could work, you know, like there's a double, you know, like it's just going past the window or the door. She doesn't hear it. The girl sitting on the floor doesn't hear it. And then it goes down and then it's sweeping around and then he attacks it up the stairs and it rips. Like I get the staging of it. I just think the actual character design, skin properties, and thus the lighting of it just looked like you'd go, yeah, no, we can't do this. That doesn't look any good.
Yeah, I just reject it. I didn't understand the, like, I get to the point of the staging. Like, I thought the scene construction was fine in terms of tension. Like, I get exactly how you would do that. My one note for that is the snake gets all bent out of shape when he shoots the arrow at it, and that's it goes like, oh my God, and it turns back around. When it turns back around, it goes upstairs. Anna Hathaway stabs it with a knife about 10 times, and it never reacts. It's just going after the kid. And I was like, what is happening? You just made a rule that you broke. Like, I don't get it. But the, point, I get the like smiley face kind of like.
The axolotl look just doesn't work though. It's no, basically I know, an axolotl with like as a snake.
But I'm saying I was like, oh, that's funny. And then it goes down, then it's, oh, it's got the big teeth. Like, okay, fine. But to your point, it's the skin. Like it didn't feel like it ever connected to anything. And it didn't feel like it had shadows. Like it felt like kind of you were watching it move through and it hit the geometry correctly. But it didn't integrate at all because of the lighting. Just there's no way to match this like slimy thing that wasn't slimy, oozing
there's
either.
There's so few reflections on it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it didn't have jelly or any sort of it wasn't leaving a residue anywhere. Like it didn't, at least I could see.
It's like it didn't know what it wanted it to be. Cause in one sense it wanted to be sticky, but it didn't leave a residue. Yeah. In one sense it wanted to be wet, but it didn't have a sense of being kind of how is it wet? Why is it wet? And also, I found like an actual snake has really interesting construction because the top of the snake is actually different from the belly of the snake. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this just felt like a tube of dodgy, semi-transparent-y kind of slimy kind of.
Well, it was like a clear plastic bag filled with like some kind of gray fluid that had a face on the end of it. But it was like this really long tubular bag.
Yeah.
And so here's what I would say. I would say if I was presented with that, and this would probably get me fired off set for being a smartass, but I'd be like, give me the basis upon which this system, this lives in a system. In other words, is it living like a boa constrictor that is taking something whole and digesting it internally, in which case that would define a certain set of teeth and a certain like, you know, way of moving and what it's trying to do with its prey? Or is it like a viper or a, you know, like a precursor to some kind of cobra, in which case it's going to rear up and attack and right down to how the eyes are positioned. If it's going to be a striking thing, it needs to have like both eyes so that it can actually determine distance really well for the strike. And if it's going to be curling up around things, then the eyes can be more like a herbivore on the side of its head kind of thing, which this guy's eyes kind of were. But everything about it, like how the eyes are, how it detects the world and how it lives in the world would also explain like why is it slimy? Is it
excreting
from it?
Yeah.
Or if it's not and it's been out of a pool for a while, then it should be dry on top but it should still be able to move. And it's not as if we don't have reptiles that you could totally access for a world of that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that one. So go on.
I was going to say narratively, the way to solve that is to have it interact with one of the other creatures.
Yeah.
Small, large, whatever. And then you go, oh, it does this, right? Exactly. Because you'll see it, how it reacts. You see how something like, oh, it's slimy because the pterodactyl tries to grab it and it slips off like a claw in a machine, you know, like.
So it comes out of the swimming pool, right? The above ground pool earlier. So if it's meant to be a water-based creature, what is its motivation for going in the top floor of a building, right? Like
when there's
like,
water in the basement.
Yeah, actually, it's like exactly
story-wise, so narratively.
It's like I just feel like, and I'm just going to go to Lord of the Rings here. On Lord of the Rings, or a film like that, where you've got you know, different tribes or different colonies of whatever coming, you know, you kind of go, well, this is why backstory matters. This is why culture matters, because once I establish the culture and the actual environment that it's come from, and I basically I give it the equivalent of an actor's backstory. And I felt like this creature didn't have a biological backstory that would have then allowed the animators and designers to complete a picture of it that made sense in the context of, and I don't just mean sort of motivation in the kind of wanky, you know, actor's studio sense, but why it would behave the way that it does and why, like, what is it seeking? What drives it? Because I think the thing about most creatures is, you know, they're not monsters. In this sense, they're creatures that are trying to live in the world. And so they're not just going to run around aimlessly just creating havoc, because that would mean expending energy for no kind of good reason. Now, if they're a cognitive race like a, I don't know, an alien slash predator, then okay, they're motivated by sport and they've got an, you know, cognitive thought pattern. But if they're an animal back in the sort of sense of a more primitive, then they're driven by some kind of behavioral response, either for safety, for food, for breeding, for something. And I think if you've given something a reason for like being like that, then everything, even though it doesn't become explicit, this is absolutely not explicit in the story, but doesn't need to be. It just fits. And it's like if you get the lighting right. Yeah.
I think they do that for the dinosaurs because they're only ever seen attacking humans. So you're telling you, you're essentially to your backstory point, they're feeding, right? They have found a new food source. They are eating. It's defenseless. They're eating it, whatever. And another scene we could probably talk about from a visual effects standpoint are the sex scene of the two dinosaurs on the house where they take the picture.
The big hairy brontosaurus.
Hairy brontosauri. And by the way, I really appreciated that they took the modern new understanding of feathered dinosaurs to this. That's a great, like it looked great. They all worked. There was no dinosaur that I was like, I don't know. Like they all felt like newer. And like, also you bought some credibility with the audience. Cause you're like, either you didn't know that and you're like, oh, that's kind of new. And maybe you looked it up when you got home, or you kind of had read that article at some point and were like, oh, interesting, but I don't know enough about it. So it all looks right. Like it's a great kind of, you know, foggy glass for the viewer to be like, this feels new and fresh and fun. And I thought all the dinosaurs were good, but this, and I thought they did this, my problem with the sex scene, the two brontosauri or brachiosauri, you know, yeah,
whatever,
sex scene is
whatever they were.
Whatever they were. Hairy.
The dino sex scene,
Hairy dinos. I thought they did a good job with speed because they're so big. They're moving very slowly. But they felt a little cartoony to me. And I don't know. Maybe it's because they blended in together because of the hair and stuff. Like
I was less worried about the cartooniness. I guess for me, like that was a funny gag in the movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the fact that they were destroying a house by like leaning on it was just sort of funny. And the fact that they then took the Polaroid gives you that kind of, you know, thing that you want, that she's got some proof that it all happened at the end. Like I'm okay with that. I guess for me, if we just talk about Jurassic Park, which is obviously the thing that you would put as a touchstone for this, there are times that you'd see herbivores in herds and behaving in certain ways because that's their defensive mechanism. Their motivation is to be herd-like, because in a herd you have protection. Yeah. And then the predators were very much predators. And of course the raptors would work as a unit in a way that you would see like sharks or, you know, killer whales kind of working. So there was like this sense that, yeah, these are herbivores, these are carnivores, these are predators, these are flocking, these are moving in patterns that are very much like you'd expect flocking behavior, because that's going to be a good defense mechanism. They move quickly so they can get out of the way. But also in the latter ones, they'd have a sense that there was an equilibrium that had been found, that like in this valley, that's where these guys are. And then over here, this is an area where the, I don't know, the T-Rexes breed or whatever. Like mm-hmm. that was that sort of territory. I think in this, it was almost like, we need another dino, so just throw one in. There was like only one or two scenes where there was any implication of herds. But like, you know, if you were a lone,
I mean, it wasn't big enough. I mean.
No, but I mean, still, it's like you could have like a stampede of a bunch of guys going through the end of town and, you know, wiping out a building or something. And also, you know, like lions, like they sleep most of the time.
Yeah.
And then they attack. But if they can't fall the prey that the antelope gets away, they kind of run out of steam and then they go, mm-hmm. oh, bugger it. I'm going to give up just chasing him forever and just lie down.
They did have a moment, though, where there was a large gathering of, I can't remember what they're called.
The turtle guys?
Like
they look kind of like turtles a little bit, but there's a moment where they're, I think they're driving, right?
And they're in the street. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's like a huge crowd of them all kind of like just moving all slow and sort of looking around and making their sound. They're not really menacing so much as like they're in a big pack, like they're crowding an area because they are. The implication I took from it was that they are moving in a herd-like way, slowly.
Well, I thought
from
that's
one
where it was going, and then
next.
It just looked like they were offering themselves up as a buffet. I'm sorry,
I didn't.
Where's the defensive mechanism of all just sitting there not moving?
I totally appreciate like all of your guys' takes on this movie, but I my instant reaction to a lot of this is like, I feel like you're overthinking it a little bit in a way. Like,
no. I'm gonna disagree with you. Personally, I don't know about Mike, but maybe this is true. I'm being this pedantic because of the potential the film had. A film that doesn't have potential, you're like, well, ugh, whatever. But because it's all there. And it's just not, for me, it's just not realized appropriately. It makes me madder because I'm like, you were almost there. Like I see it, but you just couldn't get there. And it's frustrating. And so it makes me start to pick it apart to say, well, if this had been a little better and this had been a little better and they did this and put this block over here. Oh, wow. What a painting, you know?
Matt, I'd also say as a therapy session, I have such a visceral dislike of people saying they hate CGI because I'm like, it's filmmaking.
Well, of course.
Just shut up.
Yeah.
But when you don't give good, when you sort of say to the audience, yeah, we don't care about the kind of backstory or the biological backstory that would cause this to be sensible kind of movement, sensible behavior, sensible weight distribution, whatever that is. It's just going to be, you know, fake. And then you make CGI produce the fake. Then they hate the CGI. And I'm like, you're not hating the CGI. You're hating that somebody didn't articulate if somebody had designed the snake better, the slug type snake thing better, then maybe the CGI would be magnificent. And we'd say it was really effective. And wasn't that a scary scene in the kitchen? But they hate that. They just say, oh, the problem here is CGI. The problem isn't CGI. The problem is that it wasn't an articulated, let's give the audience an intelligence as an assumption. And even though this is kind of goofy, we're not going to break the laws of physics. We're not going to make it like impossible. And we're not going to make it just like, don't look over here because if you look too hard, it makes no sense whatsoever. There can be some of that and I get you. Like, why does it go back in time? I don't know. I don't need to know, right? It just goes back in time. But there are other aspects where I'm like, no, you've just got a rampage of sex and dino violence. And that's
it does look like it is. I was just looking it up given this part of the conversation, but it does look like it's so far kind of a box office like dud. Mm-hmm. $108.5 million worldwide as of early September. Domestic gross in the US and Canada, $47.4 million, international $61.1 million. Reported production budget of around 80 to 92 million, meaning it needs to make roughly 160 million globally to break even.
Yeah.
So it's definitely behind its target. And maybe part of that is, what you guys are suggesting too, that if it would have maybe had stronger word of mouth, if it also possessed a greater fidelity to some of the
issues. Here's a completely left field reference, right? And part of my rave. Last night I watched the latest Star Trek episode, which I don't know if you're watching the latest season of Star Trek, but the latest episode is the soap opera episode, yeah. Right? And I mean, we were laughing so hard that we had to like stop it and play it back because we couldn't hear the dialogue over the amount of laughter in the room. But what it really clearly illustrates, if anyone's listening hasn't seen it yet, you should check it out, right? There's like an episode of Star Trek that for God knows what reason, I mean, let's face it, it's pretty dodgy. They have the whole episode as if it's a soap opera, and they get a star from The Days of Our Lives, which is one of the longest running soap operas in America, to be on as ship's counselor, which, you know, is just a magnificent thing. By the way, that woman is nearly 80. She has the best plastic surgeon in the world. But anyway,
who is it, Deirdre Hall?
Yeah, like it's
the woman that plays Marlena. She's, yeah,
the woman that plays Deirdre Hall's on the goat. Willis.
She's she's the only one you would pick. Yeah.
But so having her on there, like it's great, right? It's fan service and they don't mock her. But anyway, my point is this, the cinematography in that and the lighting in that is what is so fascinating. And it just shows you that the crafting of the way that something is done by those below the line is so vital to understanding like the quality and messaging. Now, of course, there's lots of gags about the acting, like, you know, people looking off into the distance for no apparent reason and like, who are you looking at? What is that?
Yeah.
But the cinematography and the framing and the blocking, like the camera department, Jason, you've seen it, right? Have you seen the app?
I have not.
Oh, you would love it, right?
At the beginning, they even comment on the cinematography. Yeah. The one character who has been asleep or knocked out in theory wakes up and is so confused why everybody's acting so weird. And he's like, did the lighting change in the ship? Yeah. Like everything's kind of like foggy, you know, there's like this pro misty kind of vibe on everything. It's pretty hilarious.
And there are scenes later where that same character, the captain, goes into a bar to have a heart to heart with his supposedly daughter. Because they play every soap opera trope, right? They're like, there's an evil twin, somebody was in a coma, there's an emergency, the doctor has a shaky hand. Oh my God, you're my father. Like, you know, I've just, you know, anyway.
So it is really funny.
But they have a moment where he kind of goes, all right, I'm going to have to play along with them. So he goes and has a sort of more serious heart to heart with this woman who isn't his daughter, but in the show's version of reality that the episode's about, has been told that she's his daughter. And they drop the lighting behind and change the dramatic lighting around during the shot, right? And it's just, it's like you look at this and you just say the way that craftspeople can understand what they're delivering in all of the aspects of the craft are so important and so beautifully like worked out. And then from the very end of the episode, they cut back to like normal Trek cinematography. Yeah. And it's like there are things in the foreground. And there are things in the foreground in the end sequence where it's normal Trek. And the things in the foreground in normal Trek make motivational sense for some reason. And the things that are in the foreground make no sense in the soap opera world.
Right.
And it's like there's just like such a great example of like, here, let's take the same sets, the same actors. It's
communication.
And just, change our visual language. And there's more makeup than there should be. There's like everything you can think of. The wigs aren't as good as they are normally. Like there's just.
Do you guys just on this thread? I just have to pull a little more. Do you guys listen to the Team Deacons podcast?
Oh episodes, yeah.
Evan? Yeah. 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 Not like, all of them, of course, but yeah.
I mean, I haven't heard all of them either, but yeah. I mean, I've listened to a good many, probably at least definitely more than half of the ones that are out there. And it, like the common thread, which I think is to what you're speaking to, Mike, about that Star Trek episode, and maybe one of the things that maybe is a little iffy in this film is that the common thread in all those Team Deacons things, when they talk to different filmmakers, costume designers, gaffers, sound guys, like and men and women and props people, like, I mean, people from all different walks of production, the number one thing is the relationships the people have with each other and the professionalism with which they each perform their duties.
100%.
And I mean, which is sort of stating the obvious, but they really kind of hammer home the idea that, you know, that kind of the collegiality and the teamwork and the mutual respect for one another's disciplines and stuff is what makes for, you know, a happy set and what makes people want to invite people to come back. And you sort of want to work with the same people. You develop a second hand and stuff. And then sometimes you mix it up and work with different people.
Yeah.
And when you're thinking about that Star Trek episode, you know, all of those things, like you're seeing all of these different departments, just like you said, like they're all like following the idea of the story and they're flipping the script on what's the normal thing that we normally do and how can we tweak it in enough ways across the board for everybody to just put it into this other zone where it feels like some Mexican telenovela, you know?
So but I will, so my point of, yeah, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, listening to both of you, and I haven't seen the episode, but I completely understand what you're talking about, is it comes down to two things. Between the crew at every level, you know, I hate to use this word, but I'll use top down, bottom up, you know, above the line, below the line, whatever. And is respect and communication, right? And then from all of those people that are creating to the audience, they are also projecting respect and communication.
This is exactly the point I'm making. This is 100% the point I'm making about End of Oak Street, right? My point is that in doing your job really well and respecting the audience, you don't notice if you're a non-geek like we are, that they dropped the lighting slightly in a different scene like they did in this Trek episode. I'm like going, oh my God, there's like complete lack of continuity on the lighting, right? But that's not a attention to detail professionalism that would be allowed on a normal Trek show. And my point is, what I didn't feel like the End of Oak Street's visual effects was giving me was that everybody that was related to those shots, be them the, you know, people that did the previs, the people that did the character design, the people that did the actual shaders and whatever, they were all singing from the same hymn book and they all had the same great kind of ability to do the best that they could. It was like when you don't pull those things off, there are all these little things that I think an average viewer doesn't really clock. Like I don't think an average viewer watching that Trek episode is going to clock all of the things that we clock in terms of the sound and the, you know, they were just,
definitely,
it was just everything, but it all adds up enormously. But of course they would like clock the fact that the actors are being hamish and overacting and, you know, doing raised eyebrows. And so here there's a sort of a tendency, I think, to look at the dinosaurs and stuff and just be thinking of it just in one kind of level of does it work compared to Jurassic. But I think it's like you have to have all your crafts, audio, everybody has to be like on their game, and in particular the writers in respecting like the intent of why things are happening to allow it to then hit the level that you want at that level.
Don't you think though that that's like maybe this is what you were alluding to, Jason, forgive me if I'm misinterpreting, but that like it's a leadership problem.
Ultimately it has to be because the director and the producers and sometimes
you create a culture and a mood and a tone for any project in the production office, in the art department, on set, you know, in post. And if you don't maintain that certain kind of tonality with everybody in terms of how you engage with them and how you respect their, you know, input and their opinions and stuff too, you can wind up in a situation where you get sort of muddy waters with a project.
I'll give you another filmic example, which is on film in the plot that resonates for me. It's in Apollo 13. And they're coming out of the simulator before anything's happened. They haven't left Earth yet, right? And I've forgotten the guy that ends up being on Earth and not going on the mission, he goes, yeah, I think I could have like maybe landed that last bit better. And Tom Hanks' character looks at him and they're exhausted and they've been in the simulator for hours. And Tom Hanks doesn't go, fuck it, doesn't matter. He goes, well, let's get this right. And they go back into the simulator again, right, to get it right. And I feel like if you're on a production where somebody goes, you know, I just think the thing with the dog isn't quite right. If somebody says, yeah, nobody will notice, that's soul destroying. But if somebody goes, well, let's get this right. What do we got to do to make that work? And not, another thing.
Two examples illustrating that. First one is a show we recently did, Spider-Man. And I think I recounted the story and we all had read it, that because Tom Holland was on Odyssey and sort of really got the like real, like, oh, I can make Spider-Man, like a real movie, not that they aren't, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's the one who would talk to the director and be like, yeah, this scene isn't working. And they would shut the show down for the day to work on the scene. Right. Like, which is exactly what you're saying. And now every production obviously can't do that, but yeah, conceptually that's where you want to be. You want to be able to say, this isn't working. I don't know why. We can't solve it right now, but let's either pivot as to something team. Else as a team, of course, as a team. And then second one is, I recently saw Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma or whatever, the Jane Schoenbrunn film, which I loved. And I had read something that I'd never heard of a director doing this before. Apparently at the beginning of every shoot day, she would hand out, or somebody would hand out, a sheet that she had constructed for the day to the entire crew, one for everybody, that said what they were shooting that day, why were they were shooting it, and what it meant to the story. And to all the comments that we're making, like, if the grip understands why the thing they're doing is as important as Hannah Einbinder or Gillian Anderson or the DP, which of course it always is, but nobody, depending on the culture of the film and the leadership, whatever, may or may not feel that way. That makes everybody march to the same thing, which to your example, current example is the Star Trek episode, where clearly everyone was firing on all cylinders and marching.
Well, it's such a great way to treat everyone with like a real serious level of respect for their craft and for the creative process, and a recognition in written form, it sounds like, right? Recognition that every single moment of every single day that this is a team sport and we're all playing together.
And it all matters.
We all rely on each other.
And to Jason's articulated point, and that is respect to the audience. Yeah. Like that is like, we're not here for some union reason that we want to do a good job and, you know, or just put it on my showreel.
All right. You guys have converted me from that cynical comment.
And that, and that film, that Camp Miasma film is a really hard film to make because it straddles slasher movies, camp, queer narratives that a non-queer, audience has to be able to understand and not feel up or down about. I mean, they may, but it has to all work. And there's like so many, and there's like a whole Sunset Boulevard narrative that's buried in there. Like so many things jammed into this movie, and it all works. You don't have to get it all right to understand it, but it feels like a great film emotionally, and you can only do that with cohesion.
But the filmmaker inviting everyone into that in that way is a really, it's not just inviting the crew, it's inviting the viewer, the audience into that too.
I've spoken in the past about Ron Howard saying that, you know, he like goes on set, just assumes everyone that's there is there to do a good job. And, you know, he doesn't micromanage them because he says why he wants something. He wants that character. I think his example is carrying a box. He's like, wants this character to come in with these boxes. He doesn't say, I want them a bunch of boxes. He says, I want him to struggle at this point to be able to bring in this stuff. And then art department goes, oh, okay, I understand what you're trying to pull off here. I'm going to give you a couple of ideas of how you could do that. You pick which one you like. But it's a motivated, well understood for plot reasons instruction, but it's not him saying, I want a small box, a medium box, a large box, and another small box. And you're going, if that's what you want, I'll do.
Because remember, every department head is a director essentially, right? They're all the head of that communal output. And so like they need to be able to communicate to their team, just like the director's communicating to their team and the producers and the ADs are connecting to their team. You know, it's triangles, you know, overlaid on everybody, and they all have to make just one big triangle.
And so in this film, as I said before, there is some really good technical dinosaur work, in terms of just like straight shots, like a shot where I go, that's really well integrated, that's really well lit. But there are other bits where I just go, I don't understand what's going on here. And then I feel like it'd be really easy just to say the CGI sucks. And I feel like it's less the CGI sucks and just that this doesn't make yeah, that doesn't have a kind of a cohesiveness to it that makes this fit in well with everything that
there are, I think, some like, and maybe it's all connected, right? But I mean, I'm sure it's all connected in some way, but there are some poor design choices that are made too. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I felt like when they drive to the end of Oak Street and there is this kind of cutoff and this sort of very sort of painterly, almost sort of mm-hmm. matte painting-ish, yeah. Very, yeah. Felt very two-dimensional, kind of, mm-hmm. you know, very thick, prehistoric jungle foliage. And it doesn't feel like we're there. It feels more like a cartoon version of what it might look like at the end of Oak Street, right? And yeah. it sort of looks that way, too, when we see the bubble event mm-hmm. from a great distance in like the newscast. And I think again at the end when they're way up on the hillside and we see it twice and it's, you know, I understand that it's this perfect bubble that's cut this out, but even still the integration of those two pieces in a shot where we're up on a hillside looking down kind of over their shoulders at this kind of scene in the distance, it just doesn't look,
I great. Totally agree. It's like, it's like a shot that feels like you're back in the days that you had to have a lock off because you couldn't do a good map.
Yeah. And it should look really, cool. Like it yeah. should be well, kind of amazing looking, but it just doesn't, they don't pull it off.
To the comment about the environmental impact of the snake, thus not understanding, you know, the whole yeah. concept of it because of that, I would argue, and I think I can articulate it better now we've had this conversation, is the bubbles themselves, right? Because the first time you really see the bubble and its result, not in the large scale, because you can't comprehend that, it's too big, yeah. is they tease it in a couple of moments when the dinosaur, when they first see the bubble, Ewan McGregor and Anne Hathaway, they see it in that house, the back yeah. of the house, and it's like, yeah. it yep. create like a light. But it created like a spherical cutout around like a piece of a car and the house. And later the tree, you know, yeah. section when at the end is that
like all the ripoff from Terminator, but anyway,
yes, but in Terminator, and you're actually making my point in Terminator, which I just rewatched, when Arnold comes through and he stands up, the ground is like melted, essentially. It's super hot. Right.
And the edge of the metal is all hot.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in this case, you see the bubble appearing and disappearing in the house. There's no interaction between the edge of the bubble and the house. Does it have to be fire and electricity? No. Be inventive. Come up with something. I don't know. But when it disappears and you see the resultant sort of negative space of a hole, it just looks like it's cut away, like you were in a blender and you just intersected something and then deleted it.
Yeah.
You know, it just
Boolean like yeah. difference operator.
Yeah. It's, you know, so that's sort of what sure it felt like.
In a blender or in Blender?
Yeah, well, both. Yeah. Program. Yeah. the script was in the blender. Yeah. But so, you know, to your point, like you should, when they go into the backyard, it shouldn't just be that new foliage is overlaid in the backyard, because it should all be, have had been interacted with, that's a yeah. correct sentence, yeah. with where the bubble had, you know, taken one half and it intersected with the other. There's no residue, there's no visual cue. And even in, to your point, in that 2D map painting, it's sort of like the edge just crumbles off and it just so happens in that shot there's a valley there or right. something to show scale, but there's no reason for it. So it doesn't, yeah. it's just to show that it's a piece. It there doesn't have one, any.
There's one short like sequence, or I think it's a couple shots, but one shot sticks out of my mind in particular that I thought was pretty outstanding, like from a visual effects standpoint, where it felt mm-hmm. like camera, comp, live action, animation, lighting, like it felt like it all kind of was clicking in place. And it's where, I want to say it's the Tyrannosaurus Rex, but maybe it's the other thing that has the big mouth with the teeth mm-hmm. in it. I don't know the name of all these dinosaurs, but like Anne Hathaway, it's like she's sort of on screen left and she's running across several like sort of lawns that are sort of
oh yeah
like kind yep. of going up the hillside from the road, And at one point, the dinosaur is really, she's got the shotgun or the rifle or whatever. And all the dinosaur is really like catching up to her. And we see it crashing through like a hedge and running across mm-hmm. the lawn. And at one point, I think it turns and it goes behind the houses. And that's when we get to this other sequence where it's sort of stalking her. And I thought that was a pretty well executed sequence where it felt like all of the composite and everything, the lighting, it just all kind of felt balanced. It felt like it was really there, as opposed to some of the shots early on of the dinosaurs where I alluded to this maybe earlier, where there was a lot of, it felt like things in the distance were still too contrasty and saturated, and they didn't quite sit in the shot in a way that I thought they should, like at the distance, like the black levels kind of seemed like they were off a little bit, but I mean...
Anyway, there was good and bad in it, we've laid into it enough, but I just want motivated. I want teams. I want whatever. But anyway, that's it for this week. We're going to move on. Thanks so much, guys, for being here. We, as always, would like to make it perfectly clear that we don't lay all our criticism at the floor, at the feet of the actual artists that worked on it, because you don't know what their direction, advice, and whatever was. But nevertheless... can't like every film. There you go. Hey, Matt, where can people connect up with you?
Just on Letterboxd. That's the only social media really I use anymore, and it's only just to talk about movies. So it's fun. I keep trying to – everything I watch, whether it's on a streaming service or in the theater, I try to at least give it some commentary.
I look forward to seeing the commentary on this one. And Jason?
Twitter, Instagram, wherever you want to try and find me, just Jason Diamond at all these things.
And I'd like to suggest, if you're listening to this and you either agree with us or disagree, people have been starting to do a bit more emailing to us. So I'd welcome
please. That.
You can use my email. It's mikes@fxguide.com, and I'll distribute it to the guys. Obviously, you can connect to them directly as well. But if you want to talk to us, whenever you talk to me, I always make sure the guys get a copy as well. So it's mikes@fxguide.com, and we welcome your input. We love it. And we've had a few debates with a few people that have been.
Yeah, welcome your critique of our.
Yeah, totally.
Yes, too,
which please. Is really so, great for sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
We get a real buzz out of it when, and we get really amazing people emailing us, supervisors and all sorts of people commenting that we didn't understand something or other, and we apologize about that and we're trying to address it. Until next time, I'm Mike Simwell. Thanks so much for being here. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.